Welcome you if you're new among us, if you're brand new to London. Welcome to London. I hope you're getting used to the food, as we've heard about. Someone told me this morning their lungs are just getting used to the extra amount of pollution that they're having to bear at the moment. Well done. It's a great city. I hope you're glad to be here. And we unashamedly would love you to join us in our church family, to have this be a place where we can serve you, where you can serve and grow, and where you can investigate Jesus if you're at the stage of looking into these things yourself. I used to work with an Australian guy called Gavin, and one day Gavin sent this picture to me and a bunch of others. He sent it round on an email. I don't know if you can see this across the top here. This is the gate of heaven. Gavin basically thought that he'd discovered some sort of secret portal, or I don't know what he thought it was, a black hole or some kind of doorway that was going to immediately transport him into the afterlife. The message that came with this on the email from Gavin said this. This is my attempt at the Australian accent. Gavin said, "Friends, it's been nice knowing you, but I found the gate to heaven. See you, everyone. I'm off." Sorry, BJ at the back. BJ gave me 1 out of 10 for my Australian accent this morning. 0. Okay, sorry. It's got worse as the day has gone on. Needless to say, though, Gavin turned up at work as usual on Monday morning. It turned out that the gate to heaven was locked when Gavin tried to enter it. It's a church building. I don't know if you can make that out. Some of you might recognize it. It's over in the East End of London. And that feels like a big claim to put at the entrance to your church, doesn't it? But it's true about every church where Jesus' people gather. This, you could say, is the gate of heaven. That's not a claim about buildings, which we're very glad about in our case. Heaven is not a 1960s teacher training college, you'll be glad to know. It's a claim about people and what God is doing among his people. The story of the Bible is the story of Jesus and his church. Here in Revelation, the churches are on a journey to a wedding where the church will marry Jesus, be his bride, live with him in a perfect world forever. The church is the gate to heaven, not because there's anything special about the people in the church. The church is where Jesus is. And Jesus is the one promising his church a new heaven and a new earth. Through the church, Jesus extends the hope of that promise to the people of the world. We're really just, you could say, the local outpost of a cosmic story. I wonder what you're excited about London. I wonder why you're here. Nothing is more exciting or important in London in 2014 than the story of what Jesus is doing through his people in the church. One of the things I love about this picture, though, I don't know if you can totally make it out, is that the entrance is a bit rubbish. The gate of heaven, really? I think that picture sums up really well what so much of the story on the ground feels like when you're part of Jesus' church. Oh yeah, we make huge claims, but Jesus' churches often do look a bit rubbish and weak. And does anyone even notice that we're here? Churches really need direction, they need help, they need vision, they need encouragement. They need correction when they're in danger of compromising with the world too much. In Revelation chapters 2 and 3, Jesus writes to his churches, 7 real churches in the first century. We're going to spend a week looking at each of them. And through Jesus' words to them, we're going to hear Jesus speak to us, to all of his people. Let me show you why that's the case. If you look at chapter 2, verse 7, so just before our reading, this was the letter we looked at last week, 2 verse 7. "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." That phrase came up in our reading. It comes up in every of these letters. It's in verse 11 of chapter 2. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. What we're trying to do at Euston, if you want to know a bit about what we think is important, it's just really simple, I hope. We just want to be a church that has an ear to listen to Jesus, and then that we do whatever flows out of that, including change where Jesus would have us change. The Spirit of Jesus is saying something to us this evening through this letter. Isn't that an amazing, exciting thing? I think I'll pray again, because it's such an amazing thing, actually, that the Spirit is going to speak to us through this letter. Father God, thank you for this amazing privilege that by your Spirit you speak to us this evening through the Lord Jesus' letters. We pray that we will have ears to hear what your Spirit says. Amen. I put a handout in the middle of your sheet there. The bit in the middle is stuff that you can look at either later, or there's a glossary of terms. If you hear me use phrases from this reading, there's a good chance there might be a little explanation of what that phrase means in the middle there. But we're going to go through these three points on the first side of that handout where it says the Jesus messages. So verse 8, here's this letter. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write. Smyrna, it was thought to be the birthplace of Homer. That's Homer the Greek dude, not the Simpson. We all know that he was born in Springfield, obviously. Fiercely loyal to Rome were the Smyrnans. If Smyrna had held a referendum and they said, do you want to leave the Roman Empire, then more than 55% of the people of Smyrna would have said, no, thanks. That's my Scottish accent. I hope slightly better than the Australian. Well, Smyrna, they won the bidding. They were the host city that was the host of the temple to Emperor Tiberius. And they really, you know, they really knew how to give Rome all the business. Rome, your power will never end. That's the sort of thing they said in Smyrna. They really knew how to suck up. And in Smyrna, loyalty to Rome, actually, that lay the seeds for the problems of the church. Jesus had no complaints, actually, about the church in Smyrna. It's interesting, we'll see in most of the other letters, Jesus has a bit of what you might call negative feedback to give to his churches. Nothing negative to say about this church. That would have been quite a good sales pitch for them, wouldn't it? If they'd been at the Freshers Fairs in September every year. We were giving out water, Euston Church water, at one of the Freshers Fairs the other day. That was our way of saying hello. Apparently, one of the churches was giving out headphones. Sorry that we haven't got a headphones budget. You can keep the pen, though, as a present from us. Do you know, when you went to the Freshers Fair and Smyrna Church were there, they could have put on their banner the church that Jesus had nothing bad to say about. Oh, really? Tell me more. Where do I sign? Just one other thing you should know, though. Persecution guaranteed if you join our church. Still want to sign up for a small group? Would you sign up for a small group in a church in Baghdad at the moment? Would you volunteer for the welcome team? Be the person on the door of a church in Syria this weekend? We have a mission partner. She's just gone to help plant churches among Syrian refugees. She came over the summer, gave us a slot so that we could pray for that work. And she told us about a man called Joseph who became a Christian, wanted to go back to Syria to tell his family and friends about Jesus. The missionaries that converted him told him he'd be mad to try and do that, but he wanted to go back and tell them about Jesus. So he did. And he started some Bible studies in Syria there for his family and friends, till he got shut down by ISIS. No one's heard from Joseph for the last few months. Maybe he's on the run. Maybe. That's maybe the best we could hope for Joseph. To the persecuted church in Smyrna, in northern Iraq, in Syria, and to his people in London, Jesus writes, verse 9, I know. The first thing that Jesus wants his persecuted people to know is that he knows all about it. And that's not because he's been sent a report up to his control room up there in HQ. Jesus walks among his churches by his Spirit, we saw last week. A very present help in times of trouble. And you can tell he's present because he knows so much of the detail. He knows their tribulation. This word for tribulation comes from a word that means to be pressed down on. It's what you do to grapes when they're in a wine press. Or imagine the walls pressing in on you. That's how it feels to be a Christian in Smyrna. And Jesus knows. He knows their poverty as well. We actually know a little bit about what was going on in Smyrna from church history. A bishop called Polycarp was martyred there in about 150 AD. And a book called The Martyrdom of Polycarp gives us some eyewitness testimony from this era. See, in Smyrna, religion wasn't just about religion, it was about economics. So the trade guilds and the businesses had gods you were expected to swear allegiance to if you worked for them. It was political too. Loyalty to Rome meant acknowledging Caesar as a god. This name Jesus uses for himself in verse 8. Do you notice how he signs in to the letter? He says he is the words of the first and the last. That's a name for God. And in the place in the Old Testament, which I put on your sheet where that quote comes from, God says, I am the first and the last. Beside me, there is no God. The Christians in Smyrna believed that. They couldn't go around acknowledging other gods. So they got sacked. Or no one did business with you. Or no one employed you. You were kind of an unlucky charm. Disloyal to the cause. The Barnabas Fund, they say that in Pakistan today, Christians are usually only able to get jobs as road sweepers or sewage cleaners. Half of Pakistan's Christians live below the poverty line. Pakistani Islam has absorbed some of the Hindu attitude of viewing Christians as unclean. And we don't know everything of the details of what was going on in Smyrna, but we do know who was behind the trouble. Verse 9. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. That sounds so strong, doesn't it? Imagine walking into any religious building in London and saying, this is a synagogue of Satan. It's not anti-Semitic. Jesus was a Jew. John, who wrote the book of Revelation, was a Jew. Loads of the early Christians were Jews. But in Smyrna, the bad-mouthing of believers came from some within that Jewish community. The Martyrdom of Polycarp says there was at least six slanders going round. They said the Christians were cannibals. Assume that was something to do with the Lord's Supper. Immoral. Breaking up homes, atheists for not worshipping these other gods, disloyal to Rome, and arsonists. Jesus says people who make claims like that, they're not true Jews, not true people of God at all. They're actually being used by Satan. He's the one behind this persecution. And we need to be really careful when we see things about persecution in the Bible and in the world. Careful before we start immediately comparing that to anything that we've gone through in our relatively free and open society that we live in. But wherever you refuse to compromise with the culture around you, you can expect to feel the seeds of slander in your refusal to compromise. Whether that's the drinking game that you won't join in with at the sports initiation, or the ancestor veneration that you decide not to take part in, or just the awkward claims of Jesus to be the only true God, claims that you decide to stand by. Expect to be slandered in small ways when you're faithful to Jesus. you're so boring and judgmental and disloyal to the honour of our family. He seems to have joined a cult. She's likely to want to bring her friend Jesus into the conversation at some point. Of course, it's not like that all the time, just like it wasn't for the Christians back then. The Roman Empire were in a real dilemma. They didn't like the fact that Christians didn't worship the gods, but they were really attracted to the lifestyle. And it's often like that today, isn't it? People are kind of, well, we want to take the mickey out of you, but we're also kind of attracted to the way of life. I hope you get involved with people who aren't Christians here in London. We don't want to hide away in a Christian huddle in any sense. But be ready for slander, misrepresentation, being misunderstood. That's a very normal thing for the people of God. And that's just the things they say in front of you. Have you ever wondered what people say behind your back? It's nothing like full-on persecution, but it's painful, isn't it? And Jesus knows. Not just that he knows what's going on. This is Jesus. Remember, he knows from personal experience what tribulation and poverty and being slandered feel like. And that Jesus is present today wherever his people experience those problems. Secondly, he says, don't fear. This is verse 10. Don't fear what you're about to suffer. Interesting that he talks about not fearing what they're about to suffer. Often the prospect of what's about to happen or what might happen in terms of suffering is a tactic the devil uses to keep us quiet. So I don't know, in London, many people who've lost their jobs for being a Christian. I know one or two who've been told off. But I know lots of people who fear what might happen if they were bolder as Christians in their workplace or their uni. And just that fear often makes us decide to go quiet on our own, doesn't it? The authorities in the workplace and in the student bodies don't have to officially tell us to stop doing anything. I wonder what you fear might happen to you because of an association with Jesus. This week, new to London, Freshers Week for lots of you guys, making new friends. I can just about still remember my Freshers Week. And I remember really vividly feeling anxious about the moment when I was going to have to tell the guys I was getting to know that actually I was a Christian. And I was anxious about what they would then think as they saw the consequences of that lived out. How would they feel when I tried to even persuade them to investigate Jesus? Smyrna Church seemed to have a pretty high pain threshold for troubles compared to me. And yet they still feared the future. Interesting pastoral care from Jesus. He doesn't say, don't worry, nothing more bad will happen. He says the opposite in verse 10. Don't fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Thanks a lot, Jesus. That's really comforting. I think the comfort comes from the fact that Jesus is in control. It says for 10 days they'll have tribulation. That's very precise, isn't it? Could be literal 10 days. The devil could do a lot of damage to a local congregation with 10 days of tribulation. But lots of the numbers that we meet in the book of Revelation are symbolic. So the one you might have heard of famously is the number 666, which seems to symbolize the devil in Revelation. And you sometimes see these stories in the tabloid papers where, you know, a person gets a phone call and the number that came up was 666. Should I answer it or not? Well, the number 10 is not quite as evocative. It's got a few connections back in the Old Testament. One is that Daniel and his friends were tested for 10 days. I think the big point is that it's a specific period of time that Jesus knows, and more than knows, is in control of. Later in the book of Revelation, the devil is personified. He's this like great dragon who's been defeated and chucked out of heaven. But he's like a mortally wounded beast. He's still thrashing around, causing mayhem in his death throes. We need to take him seriously. But we don't need to fear that he will win. Some of the stories coming out of Iraq and Syria at the moment, it must really feel like the devil is winning. Those Christian brothers and sisters might suffer more. Jesus says don't fear because he's in charge. He's the one that sets the limits on how long his people's persecution can be allowed. Next is question, doesn't it? Why does Jesus allow the persecution then in the meantime? We don't know all the answers. But it's interesting that it's been the case through history that actual persecution has often strengthened the church, often been something that God has directly used to further his next stage of his plan. We live in the middle of the story. We don't know all the answers. It's painful when you live in the middle of the story. People talk about whether it will get worse for Christians in the UK. Could there come a time in our lifetimes where you even got sent to prison for Christian beliefs? Who knows? Jesus knows. Jesus knows the limits. And wonderfully, he has told us how this story will end. Be faithful unto death. Verse 10, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Again, it's unusual comfort, isn't it? Jesus is suggesting that, oh yeah, after this prison thing, some of you will die. It did happen in Smyrna. This Bishop Polycarp was one of the martyrs, and it happens in Jesus' churches today. Here's a report I read from the 14th of September, just 2 weeks ago. Gunmen attacked three villages in Nigeria's Plateau State this month, burning down a church building and killing at least 10 Christians. The pastor writes, our church members, whose major occupation is in farming and agriculture, are dying of hunger as they're not able to go to their farms because they're being attacked on their farms too by these gunmen. It's awful, isn't it? Christians. Poor them. Poor Smyrna. Actually, rich Smyrna, says Jesus. Did you see that? The little bit in brackets in the start of verse 9. Your poverty, but you are rich. How can Jesus say that to people who are poor, some of them going to die? Well, he's not downplaying their hurt and their fear at all. But the church of Smyrna, the gate to heaven in Smyrna, remember? These guys had promises that no terrorists could touch or take away. At the end of our little letter, in verse 11, you see that Jesus says the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. That's a description of horrible judgment that comes at the end of Revelation, the second death. It's fire. It's something that would scare you. Jesus' people don't have to be scared of the second death. And end of verse 10, I will give you the crown of life. Do you know, actually, in the original Greek, it says, I will give you the crown of the life. It's like an extra the. And basically, in New Testament Greek, that's as close as you ever get to exclamation marks and smileys that are highlighting something that's really cool and really important. I will give you the life, says Jesus. You know, some of the language that we use, it just doesn't help, I think. I even use the phrase afterlife earlier. It's not after life, it's the life. This is the pre-life, you might say. Even the word heaven, yeah, fine, it's a new heaven, but it's a new earth as well that Jesus promises. Walking with God, being with each other in a real garden, paradise, that will last forever. Fully alive, fully restored, all the problems gone. It's a city, but without the hurt. This is the story that the Christians in Smyrna are part of. And that's why Jesus can say to them, be faithful unto death. It's not crazy to be loyal to Jesus, even if death is what it costs you. And I think it must be so hard, mustn't it, for these Christians in Iraq and Nigeria and Syria today. Can they see this view? Can they see past the pain to the longer view? It must be so tough. It must be so tough to respond in godly ways, not to retaliate to enemies, but to forgive. We need to pray for these brothers and sisters. The message to them is they can take your life, but they cannot touch your destiny. Be faithful unto death. That was what Jesus called the church at Smyrna to. And that is what Jesus calls us to as well. I don't know if you think much about what the calling of your life is. What's Jesus' calling for your time here in London? Well, it's very simple. Be loyal to Jesus, up to and including dying, if necessary. Do you know, I don't think about that very much. I think partly because by the end of saying that previous sentence, I'd already caveated myself out of it in my head with the line, "It will never happen." Well, it might not, but it is what you sign up for if you're a believer in Jesus. Remember, take up your cross and follow me. Jesus knew that for a lot of people, that would not be just a metaphor. And so I think the challenge I've been thinking about, and I'd love to challenge all of us with, is this week to think about your calling. Spend some time reflecting on your calling to be faithful unto death. I'm aware it's not a very cheery thing to think about. What did you learn at church tonight? Be faithful unto death. Well, that's really cheerful, isn't it? But I think it would help me if I thought about that a bit more. For one reason, it might help me remember brothers and sisters in the world for whom that is exactly the issue they face today. You know, there's lots of great websites and information in a global village that means that we can pray and give and find other ways to support persecuted Christians around the world. I feel quite convicted that personally and as a church, we could do more. We're going to, at our prayer night in a couple of weeks, pray in more detail for the persecuted church. I think if I thought about this calling to be faithful unto death, it would make me ask the question more in my head, can I trust Jesus if the stakes are that high? That story from Nigeria, did you notice the date? 14th of September. I read another one from Nigeria that was dated the 7th of September. This is the 28th of September. Did you notice what that means about those dates? They're Sundays. That's people turning up to church and getting killed. I don't know about you, that's never been a worry for me. I've never thought, I wonder if that will happen to me at church this evening. I love church. But when you might die at church, that might make you question, wouldn't it? Is this really the gate to heaven? Or is this just a gateway to pointless pain? Can you trust Jesus with your death? Well, there's a great little line in this letter to Smyrna that reminds us that we can. It's in verse 8, and again, it's Jesus talking about who he is. Verse 8, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. Remember, Jesus is been through the Smyrna experience and come out alive the other end. Jesus is an expert in the resurrection business. It's great to be singing about it. I love the songs that we sing about the risen Jesus. It's a great event in that it baffles historians. Lots of non-Christian historians have written stuff where they basically say it seems like it all pans out, but we just obviously can't believe that it really happened. I read one thing by a really intelligent guy writing a really big piece of work, and his theory at the end of it was basically that Jesus must have had an evil twin who suddenly appeared and started putting himself around the place. It's what used to happen in the soaps in America in the 1980s. Someone comes back as an evil twin. And I don't want to laugh at that because I'm aware that to say Jesus rose is a big claim. But maybe it just is that it really happened. There's some booklets at the back. I'd love you to take one away. They're about the evidence for the resurrection. I take it that for Christians in Iraq and Nigeria today, having resurrection beliefs is not just a nice thing so that you can have that argument with your friend. Having resurrection beliefs is necessary to remind you why you bother going to church today. Just if you're investigating Jesus as well, I'd say to you, focus on the resurrection. Work out what you make of it. Because the call is to take up your cross and follow Jesus. You'll need to be really clear and sure that that would be worth it. You know, I think you probably won't get killed tomorrow by the HR department or by the university authorities. In fact, I think I'd guarantee it. I think if they try to, you can tell them they've well overstepped the mark of their authority if anyone at the uni or HR tries to kill you tomorrow. Loyalty to Jesus probably won't mean faithful unto death for most of us at the moment. Some of us will go to parts of the world in the future where it might be more likely, though. And it is worth reflecting on which way you would swing if it came to that. And let that thought, as I've been trying to this week, spur me on to raise my own pain threshold. Because faithful to Jesus might mean faithful unto abuse or suspicion or lost reputation. Faithful unto Jesus might mean unto family resentment. It might mean faithful unto rejection by the friendship group. If Jesus is saying, be faithful unto death, wouldn't be crazy, then maybe that means I could trust him with those lesser threats as well. Maybe it means I could be a bit bolder, a bit clearer about Jesus tomorrow with the people that I'm going to see who aren't Christians. I'm thinking about the antenatal class that we're going to be at tomorrow night. That's what we hang out doing on Monday evenings at the moment, an antenatal class. And, you know, I wouldn't try to get it in a weird way. You know, oh, everyone, Jesus was once a baby himself. Did you know? Try to do it not so clunkily, but fear of what they might think. It's such a clever tactic that the devil uses against me. It might not go down well. It might be the wrong time. I might be misunderstood. Maybe I could just go for it a bit more and trust the outcomes to the one who controls all the outcomes. That's what Polycarp did. He really went for it when he had to make a stand back in Smyrna. And it cost him his life. This is what the reports of it said. He'd been asked to say, Caesar is Lord, but refused. Swear and I will set you free. Reproach Christ. Polycarp answered, 86 years I've served him, and he never did me any injustice. How can I now blaspheme my King and Saviour? They pressed him again. I am a Christian, said Polycarp. We've got wild beasts at hand, said the proconsul. But Polycarp replied, you threaten me with fire, which burns for an hour, and after a little is extinguished. But you are ignorant of the fire of the coming judgment. Why do you wait? Bring forth what you will. Soon after, the people began to gather wood. And it says, thus Polycarp was burned at the stake. It's inspiring stuff, isn't it? Horrible stuff. There's nothing romantic about dying like that. But Polycarp, he knew about the crown of life. I take it he'd read this letter to his own church in Smyrna, and he trusted the words of Jesus to the church in Smyrna. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.